Currently, 200 million women want to plan their families, but lack the means or access to do so. And this is in a world where demand for contraceptives is increasing while funding for this is decreasing. So at the heart and the core of our work is ensuring access to voluntary family planning services.
Hello, everyone. I'm Maurice Jones, the Director of Development for the Miller Center Foundation. I'm filling in for my colleague, George Gillum, who is away scouting locations for the Miller Center's National Discussion and Debate Series today. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. We are honored that today's forum is co-hosted by the Blue Ridge Chapter of the United Nations USA in honor of United Nations Day. We thank the members of the Blue Ridge Chapter and their president, Helen Reynolds, who is here with us today, for bringing our speaker to the Miller Center. Sarah Craven is chief of the United Nations Population Fund's Washington office. Her organization recently released its annual State of the World Population Report, which examines the increasing urbanization of the world's population and the need to focus on the urban poor. She has worked at the U.S. State Department and the Center for Development and Population Activities. Before that, she was a staff attorney at the National Women's Law Center and served on the legislative staff for two U.S. senators. Ms. Craven holds a master's degree from Cambridge University and a law degree from the Georgetown Law Center. Please join me in welcoming Sarah Craven.
Thank you very much. I'd really like to thank Maurice and the Miller Center for Public Affairs for inviting me here today, and the Blue Ridge Chapter of the UN Association. So I'm delighted to be here in honor of UN Week and Happy UN Day, which was a few weeks ago. I'm going to talk to you today about my agency, UNFPA, or the UN Population Fund. Now, depending on who you might talk to, we're either the most important development agency within the UN, we are the most obscure development agency within the UN, or maybe we're the most infamous. And hopefully when you leave here today, you're going to decide that we are the most important. At least that's my hope. Our mandate is to ensure that every pregnancy is wanted, every birth is safe, every young person is free of HIV/AIDS, and every young girl and woman is treated with dignity and respect. For millions of women and girls, a life of health and equal opportunity is threatened by violence, discrimination, poverty, and other ills. And our mandate is to provide support, the expertise, and the partnership to change this unacceptable state of affairs. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that mandate and the opportunities that we have and the challenges that we face. Before we get there, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of UNFPA and the population movement. I understand some of you in the audience may have some familiarity, so maybe when we get to the question and answer, you can tell me if I'm right in terms of how I believe UNFPA began. It was in the late 1960s when UNFPA was created. I had the pleasure this summer of meeting Ambassador Thomas Gardner, who at that time was the special advisor to the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. in the Johnson administration. And he did a lot of the groundwork within the U.N. to really call for a new fund to focus on population activities around the world. At that time, when people looked at population growth, there was great concern about population growth being unchecked. That there was worries about population pressure leading to concerns on national security. Many of you may be familiar with a book that was popular at the time called The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. There was also back then a young congressman that many of you may have heard of named George Bush. He was very concerned with population growth in the U.S. Congress. So this was a lot of the feeling at the time when UNFPA was created. But over the years, when folks looked at population and the fact that population needed to be controlled, that would result in sort of two different approaches. One would be countries that were worried, actually, that they didn't have enough population, that they needed to have more citizens. And if you look back at some of the Eastern European countries, which were focused on a pronatalist approach, they would part laws and regulations that would make it very hard for women to control their fertility. You can meet women, I have met women from Romania of a certain generation who have had 9, 10, or 11 abortions because they had no access to contraceptives because they were illegal. In contrast to that, you can look at other countries that were worried about unchecked population growth. These are countries such as China or India that were very concerned about controlling their population. And this results in what we're all very familiar with, the one-child policy, which then would result in great abuses where women were forced to have abortions or sterilizations against their will. So these were sort of the different tenors that were going, and the world really came together in 1994 to really look at population in a completely new and different way. And there was a major landmark conference in Cairo, Egypt, some of you may be familiar with. It was called the International Conference on Population and Development. And those of you who are familiar with the UN know that we like to use acronyms a lot. So we call that the ICPD, or we call it the Cairo Consensus. And what happened in Cairo was 179 countries came together and said, we are going to look at population in a new way that puts people, particularly women, at the center. And it came forward with a 20-year plan of action that put people in the center and that allowed that all couples and individuals have the right to freely and voluntarily decide the number, timing, and spacing of their families and have the means to do so. It put forward a plan of action that really focused on empowering women, giving women access to education, to health care, to economic opportunity. And this has been the blueprint that guides the work of my agency, UNFPA. Some people have said that we talk about Cairo, that that's the new population bomb, and I'm using the word B-A-L-M, which would be empowering women. And this is where our focus is. Subsequent to Cairo, the world again gathered to develop the Millennium Development Goals, which were endorsed by world leaders in 2005 with the goal of halving world poverty. We at UNFPA see that our work implementing the Cairo Consensus is a great underpinning to also achieving the Millennium Development Goals and ending poverty as we know it. We have a particular focus on two of the Millennium Development Goals, which are number 4, focused on improving child health, and number 5, and focused on improving maternal health. And just a few weeks ago, the UN General Assembly endorsed a new target on reproductive health in the MDG monitoring framework. And this is now going to make sure that governments hold themselves accountable to achieving universal reproductive health for all people by the year 2015. And that means that governments need to make this a political priority and an investment priority. What I'd like to do for you now is to really kind of talk a little bit about, as I say, our mission and what that means in practical terms and focusing on our work. The first piece of our mission is ensuring that every pregnancy is wanted. Currently, 200 million women want to plan their families but lack the means or access to do so. And this is in a world where demand for contraceptives is increasing while funding for this is decreasing. So at the heart and the core of our work is ensuring access to voluntary family planning services is critical. According to a recent study, affordable contraception is available only in about 14 out of 88 developing countries. And what we're doing is working with governments and non-governmental organizations to ensure that we can provide access to accurate information, a wide range of safe and affordable contraceptive methods, and sensitive counseling. Study after study has shown that the level of unintended pregnancy is lowest in countries where there is greatest access to effective methods and women play a bigger role in decision making. Every minute, I'm going to be talking a lot about what happens every minute around the world, but every minute, 190 women are facing the possibility of an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy that could be prevented if they had access to contraceptives. And every minute, 650 people can contract a sexually transmitted infection. 10 are newly infected with HIV simply because they don't have access to condoms. There is a statistic that is often bandied about that there is 5 condoms for every man in Africa per year. that is how much the access is. And one of the challenges that we face is making sure that contraceptives are given or are readily available. I have a colleague who often says that you can go to the ends of the earth and you can find a Coca-Cola and you can find a Marlboro cigarette. Why isn't that we can't find some basic health care as well? So part of what we're doing at UNFPA is working with the world and global community to ensure a ready supply, a sustainable supply, and that involves both ensuring that the funding is there for these commodities, but also the health care systems are there to get the commodities where they need to be. A second key and core part of our mandate, where I'm going to be talking in the bulk of my remarks this morning about, is really ensuring that every birth is safe. And I say this having come back last week to a conference I went to in London called Women Deliver, where the really international leaders, ministers of health, funders, government officials, NGOs, all came together to focus on the issue of safe motherhood. Every minute a woman dies during pregnancy and childbirth, largely through preventable causes. And if you want to have a visual, that is the equivalent of 2 747s crashing every day. We firmly believe, and I'm sure all of you firmly believe, that no one should die giving life. Currently, the new numbers, statistics were released at this conference. In the developed world, 1 in 7,300 women die in pregnancy. In the developing world, it's 1 in 75. In Africa, it's 1 in 26. And in Afghanistan, a woman faces a risk of dying of 1 in 7. So these are the statistics that we're facing, and unfortunately, in the 20 years that we've had what we call the Safe Motherhood Movement, those statistics have not moved in the way they need to in terms of going down. So the main focus of this conference was, why is that, and what do we need to do to gather the political will to bring a change? Maternal mortality displays the largest gap, whether it's in our country or in any country in the world, but the largest gap between rich and poor. And 99% of it is occurring in the developing world. For every woman who dies in childbirth, there is an additional 10 to 15 million women who suffer debilitating disabilities or illness. One of the conditions that is very unknown is called obstetric fistula. 2 million women that we know of are suffering from this condition. We say at UNFPA, obstetric fistula is hard to talk about, but it's easy to cure. What it is when a young woman is in, usually a young woman, it can happen to any woman, is in the process of an obstructed labor, there's a rupture in the birth canal that occurs during this process. The baby, almost every time, is born stillborn, and the process of the birth is so violent that it causes a fistula or a hole between her rectum and her bladder. These women then leak urine and feces for the rest of their lives. They become very smelly. They're ostracized in their communities and often abandoned by their families and their husbands. They live with great shame and great sadness. We at UNFPA have launched the first campaign to end fistula. It's currently working in 40 countries. People don't know that fistula was actually quite common here in this country. The first fistula hospital was actually where the Waldorf Astoria stands today in New York City. So we were able to eradicate fistula in our own country in our own time, and this is what we are focusing on in the rest of the world. Our campaign has three components. One is preventing fistula, and how do we do that? The focus of preventing fistula is the same we would do to also prevent maternal mortality. What is needed is to ensure that women have access to family planning so they can control their fertility. Two, that they have some form of skilled attendance during delivery, whether in an ideal situation it's a doctor, a trained midwife, or even a traditional birth attendant who hopefully has had training by UNFPA or some other agency. And then, of course, access to emergency obstetric care if complications arise. In our campaign, we focus again on the prevention side. We also focus on the treatment side. It only costs $400 US to repair a fistula. And in most cases, when women are repaired, they are completely able to go back and have more children and participate in the lives of their communities. And the final aspect of our campaign is what we call restoring hope. Because often these are women who have suffered for many years, have been very ostracized, so it's really a psychological process of getting them able to feel that they can go back and be full members of their community. There's a very famous fistula hospital in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, that some of you may have heard about. It's gotten a lot of media attention. There, one of the things they do when the women are repaired that we have replicated in other programs is they give the women a new dress, and they give them money to go back into their community and be involved in some micro-enterprise. They give women access to education, and they also give them the knowledge of what they need to do the next time that they have a birth, that they need to travel to another birth center so that they have someone who can assist them during their next pregnancy so that they can have a better outcome. To kind of give you a perspective or to put some real-world context, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about today about a trip that I went on a year ago to Ethiopia, because I think hearing some real-world stories about this can give some of these statistics more life or more understanding. I went to Ethiopia a year ago. I actually was very fortunate to travel with some staff from members of the U.S. Congress and some leaders from faith-based organizations. I'd never been to Ethiopia before. It's a beautiful country, and there are 77 million people living there in Ethiopia. For 77 million people, they have 104 OBGYNs, and of those 104, only half are practicing. Can you imagine? Of those 50 OBGYNs, 52 or so, most of them are in the main city, Addis Ababa. So lots of the population, the rural population, are living in great poverty. Women have a complete lack of education, and there's great disparity between the genders in terms of equality and rights. We traveled to an area in the Amhara province where UNFPA's research has shown we've done studies where we interviewed young adolescent girls, and 70% of those girls that we interviewed reported that they had their first sexual initiation within marriage before they had their first menstrual period. So these are very young girls who, for traditional or cultural reasons, are getting married, and then they're getting pregnant before their bodies are fully ready to have a child. One of the organizations I partner with is an organization called the UN Foundation, which was started by Ted Turner when he gave his gift of $1 billion to the UN. They have a campaign on the adolescent girl, and they often say that the most important person in the whole world is the adolescent girl, because the decisions that we make as an international community about her and her ability can make a huge difference or change in the world. So those adolescent girls that I met when I was in Ethiopia, these young married child brides, often they are working very hard. When they get married, they have to leave school. Often that they are getting married because their families don't have enough money to pay the school fees for them to go to school as well. So these young girls are married. They also have the job of having to walk to get the wood to make the fire. They have to walk to get the water. They're doing the equivalent of a major physical workout, and they're the last person to eat culturally. Their father, their husband, the men around the table have to eat before they do. So they're very nutritionally denied, and as a result, they're stunted. So they're young, they're nutritionally deprived, and then these are the young girls who are getting married, and they're in a rural area where when they go and have this obstructed labor, few know what's going on. They know that the baby is supposed to come, but they don't know what to do when the baby doesn't come. Part of that trip, we went to an area called Deborah Marcos, where we met with an OBGYN, as I say, one of the few. His name is Dr. Petros. He is the OBGYN for 3.4 million people. And he said that when women got to his small maternity center, the lucky ones who got there, because many, they don't have cars, they're coming, if the lucky ones maybe have a cart with a donkey, many are walking for days. When they get there, usually they're so far gone, he was losing 2 to 3 women a day, and his work was further hampered because he didn't have any sutures or transfusion bags to be able to aid him in his work. We asked him, I always say he was sort of a little bit out of central casting. He was so eloquent and articulate. We decided to videotape him, and one of my colleagues asked him, there must be so many opportunities for you elsewhere in the world. You know, what keeps you here to do this work, making him so noble? And he said, can you get me out of here? I'd like to get, he didn't see it as noble. He saw this as where he was. And we asked him, I said, well, what could be the best thing to help you with your work? I had met some people earlier who had talked about helicopters to bring women to emergency obstetric centers or two-way radios. I was expecting some kind of answer or an ambulance. And he said, please bring family planning to these women. These women have no way to space their births. They want to have healthy, good outcomes. They want their children to live. This is what he asked us for. To give you some good news about Ethiopia, there is an amazing minister of health there who is working with us and with other international agencies with a very limited budget and a limited health system to do what he can. They're working as a big focus in Ethiopia to increase the number of midwives. And also, this minister of health has been very visionary in that he is working with the lowest level health workers to train them not only on how to see the signs of an obstructed labor, but also, if necessary, to have to perform a cesarean section. We're working to upgrade all of the maternity centers, especially the one that Dr. Petros is at. We're working in partnership with an organization many of you are familiar with, Médecins Sans Frontières, to ensure that over a several-year plan, these maternity centers are going to be increased and that they will be able to handle emergency obstetric care. And then we need to get the word out so that people know that when they are a few days out or a few weeks out, that they need to travel. And if they're in the rural areas, they need to get where somebody will be able to help them. Some of our work is also focused on bringing these same kind of life-saving services in emergency settings. If any of you have ever seen ER, you know that babies come in elevators and taxi cabs. You know, babies they decide when they're going to come. And similarly, they come in situations of conflict or natural disaster. And that's when there has to be an urgent intervention because it can make the difference between life or death. So I was told not to bring too many visual aids. I brought one. I don't know if you'll even be able to see it. This is a very simple intervention. It costs about $1.25, and it is a safe delivery kit. And this is a sheet of plastic, a bar of soap, a piece of string, and a razor blade. And that can simply mean the difference between life or death in, for example, an emergency situation to provide a sterile surface for a woman to deliver her baby. So in certain situations, we're delivering these or handing out. We also hand out personal hygiene kits, because when a woman has faced either a situation of a natural disaster or a conflict, just to be able to have things like a bar of soap, sanitary napkins, a comb. We found after the tsunami that women were not going to access emergency food that was being delivered because they didn't have a veil to cover their head. So to provide what women need for personal dignity, to also ensure that women's personal safety is being taken care of. In situations of conflict, there is a huge rise in sexual violence. So whether it's a refugee camp situation, to make sure that women can even have safe access to a latrine without feeling that they could be at risk. We did a campaign in Liberia where we focused on all the people who were trying to bring change to ensure women's safety. And it went from the head, from the president of Liberia, to the women's lawyer who was advocating for their rights, to the man who changed the light bulbs along the path so that women could make safe access to personal services. But gender-based violence is a huge issue around the world and one that we have taken great strides to try to address in partnership with other UN agencies. Another central part of our mandate is ensuring that every young person is free of HIV/AIDS. Half of the world's population, there's 7 billion people on Earth, and half of them are under the age of 25. I don't know if any of them are here today, but I like to call them the teen tidal wave. There's this huge number of young people entering their reproductive years around the world. And the choices that we make in terms of meeting their educational aspirations, their economic aspirations, and addressing their reproductive health needs is going to make a huge difference for the rest of the world, because all young people aspire to a better future. So at UNFPA, we take that very seriously. Young people are the fastest growing population of new infections for HIV/AIDS, and we believe they must be at the center of all prevention efforts. And they also need to be at the center of all programs that are designed to benefit them. One aspect of our work that I'm very proud of is that we have actual young people who are on staff, who are part of our youth team, that really help to contribute to our youth programs, our youth materials, and then after they've had some time at headquarters, they then go back to their home countries and work in our field offices. Because we're never going to be successful in reaching youth if we're not developing programs that youth find credible and sensitive to their needs. Finally, the last aspect of our mission that I want to focus on today is the idea that every girl and woman is treated with dignity and respect. Girls are born around the world, and many face a lifetime of vulnerability and ill health, and this should not be the case. Our work has to focus and must focus and pay attention to culture, to gender, and to human rights, because all human beings, whether they are men or women, are entitled to equal rights and protection. I often say, when I said that we might be the most infamous UN agency, the kind of work we're dealing with is involving the most intimate and personal decisions that people make in their lives. When to have a family, who to have a family with, who to engage in the most intimate decisions that you make, decisions about gender relations. And if we were not going to, if we were not sensitive to how this is reflected in both the culture and based in the community, we are never going to be successful. So in all of our work, we make sure that we are working at the community level and we are involving all aspects of that community. We have programs working with Buddhist monks. We have programs working with imams. We work with leaders in the Catholic Church. We work with women's groups. We work with men, and we work with boys. We want to make sure that all partners have a voice, and that involves hard work in terms of dialogue and listening and involving in joint programming. Recently, a week ago, we released some new research, which was very disturbing, because it shows the gender imbalance that results due to prenatal son selection. In certain Asian cultures where there is a great preference for boys, women are, due to cultural pressures, making decisions to abort their baby daughters, or there's evidence of infanticide. And this is now resulting in great disparities in terms of more boys than girls in some cultures. And countries are going to face what happens when you have this great gender imbalance. It makes life much more difficult for girls, and it makes it more difficult that when they grow up, men are going to be seeking wives when there are not going to be enough girls for wives. So this results in sexual violence, for trafficking. We're already seeing areas where women are being kidnapped and brought into other regions. And this is all rooted at cultural preferences, where boys are valued more highly than girls for many, many cultural reasons. We're using this research to show it to these countries where there's been the greatest gender imbalance between boys and girls, and working with them to develop programs that heighten awareness and support the need and care for girls. In China, we have publications that have been going door to door, highlighting and promoting the rights of girls and making sure that girls, have access to education, to health care, to economic opportunity. Some of our other kind of work I wanted to highlight, in Yemen, we've developed guidebooks for working with imams that relate family planning and reproductive health to the Quran and stress the Prophet's teachings that promoted the equality of women. Our executive director is a Saudi woman by birth, and she has gone to many countries in the Mideast and worked with local religious leaders. We have these wonderful photos where she's in a room like as many of you, except they're all imams, and she's there giving them all their diplomas for their having passed a certificate in gender equality and reproductive health. So this is the kind of work that we're moving forward on. In Kenya, We have had great success working at the local level around the issue that many of you may have heard about in the media called female genital mutilation. In that area, this is again a cultural practice where well-meaning families are putting their daughters into these situations because they believe that this is what they need to do to make them ready to be women or enter puberty. So we've worked at a community level with community leaders to have an alternative ritual, to take all that part of the culture that's good, the part of the teaching of the girls of what it means to be a woman in that community, to celebrate that, but to take out the cutting, to take out the harmful practice. So that is starting to spread in terms of other people, communities. And again, this is the kind of practice that when you bring the change, you can't just focus on the women and the girls. You also have to focus on the males, the boys, the elders in the community, and have everyone work together to embrace that practice and embrace that change. Just to give you, to tell you about this work, and I'm going to, in a few minutes, open it up and delighted to dialogue with you about our work. We did this last year in 154 countries around the world, and we, unlike the UN itself, completely rely on voluntary contributions from member states. And I think for me, one of the things that makes me most proud about the work that we do is last year we received donations from 180 countries, and that included every country in sub-Saharan Africa and every country in Africa made some financial contribution to our work, including a $100 symbolic contribution from Afghanistan. So to me, it shows that the work that came forward in Cairo is still embraced by the nations of the world, that the work that we are doing is wanted and needed, and countries are coming together and saying that they want to work with the UN in partnership to ensure that women and girls are valued and protected. And all of us here today, I'm just so delighted to see that so many came out on this beautiful morning, but we're all members of the international community, and most importantly, we all share a common humanity. And by promoting the rights of women and their health, we advance the cause of human rights for all. So I'm delighted you're all here today, and I'm happy to talk to you in question and answer.
I wanted to begin our Q&A here by asking you about the cultural challenges that you face. You've mentioned some successes, but then there are other challenges that are still out there. What are the keys to this to a successful changing of culture when you've gone into these different countries and these different types of cultures? What are the first couple of steps that you need to take in order to successfully change that culture?
Okay. Well, I think, you know, success is to absolutely work at the community level. We are benefited by international human rights standards that we are going to have as the overarching principle, but we're never going to be successful if we impose these from on top and bring them down. So we have to work at the community level. Working with grassroots women's organizations is often essential. After the Cairo conference, there were some grassroots women who actually took a van and they went around their community with a loudspeaker, letting everyone in every village know what their government had agreed to in Cairo so that people would make sure that their government was held accountable. But again, to bring cultural change, we're dealing with the most intimate decisions people make in their lives, so it's going to be hard. And there's great culturally held beliefs on many of these issues. So it's making sure that we have all partners in the community engaged, that people are able to dialogue, and that people can realize that this is acceptable to their culture.
I am going to start out by saying that I'm in shock and awe. I'm shocked at what you've told us. I'm sad about it. I'm in awe of you and all the people who are making a difference.
Well, thank you.
I became a young faculty member here in 1970 at UVA, having finished my residency in OBGYN, and that was the year that the university was going to go co-ed, and I thought we might have some problems here after hearing what you've talked about. We didn't really have any problems here, but we did start a women's health center. We provided contraceptive services and women's health services to the new co-eds here. We think that made a difference. I would love to see that effort be able to take place on a worldwide basis. I just want to thank you for all you're doing, and I'm sitting here just feeling so helpless.
Oh, well, I didn't want to bring a sense of, well, thank you very much, and I'm sorry if I didn't give more hope. I think that there is great hope. I came away from this London meeting feeling that there was renewed energy, and I should have focused on some of that. The Norwegian government has pledged $1 billion focused on safe motherhood and safe mortality. British government pledged $200 million to UNFPA for this work. So I'm hoping that these energies have been marshaled and that I can come talk to you again in 5 years and say that great change is happening. I think that people at the country level absolutely see the need, and it's just making sure that the political will meets the needs of women. There were 6 women who came to this conference in London who were all fistula survivors. One woman, her name was Sarah, she was from Kenya. The first time she had been sexually initiated was she was raped. And from that pregnancy, she lost the child and had a fistula. So for 12 years, she lived with a fistula. She had no idea why. She thought this was something God had given her, some punishment for something in her life. She was repaired this past April. She came to the London conference. All of these women, none of them had ever been on an airplane before. And to get everywhere, you had to go up this escalator. So they would all like jump on the escalator, hold on for dear life. It was really amazing. And this woman, Sarah, got up before 5 U.S. members of the U.S., women members of the U.S. Congress, and told her story with such power and such conviction. And those members of Congress were wiping the tears from their face. And they have now come back with new restored purpose. So getting the political will, motivation, and I wish I'd given you more hope. There's hope. We're moving forward.
Well, that actually leads me into my question. I understand you are currently not getting any funding from the United States for your agency. Question is why, and what can we do to change that?
Oh. Well, I will say, as an American, it's very disheartening to me that we have not been funded for the past 6 years. When I mention the 180 countries that fund us, there's just a handful that don't, including the United States. And as an American working for the UN, it's very disappointing to me. The reason we have not been funded centers on one country, and that's the work that we're doing in China. After the 1994 Cairo conference, we took 2 years to negotiate with the Chinese for us to have a program based on the Cairo agenda and based in human rights. That program we have is a small demonstration project, and it's focused on working with the Chinese that they can still meet their demographic goals while still respecting the rights of their citizens. That program is very small in terms of where it is in China, and China is a very complicated country within to work. We've had great success within that small program. In the counties where we're working, at the beginning of the program, women basically had one contraceptive choice. They could use IUD. Now women had a wide range of options, including natural methods they could choose from. For me, what was really shocking was women were asked at the beginning of our survey, you know, who makes your decision on family planning? And they would say, my mother-in-law, my husband, or the state family planning worker. Now women were making their own decisions. And in those counties where we're working, gynecological visits went up, prenatal and postnatal visits went up, and the abortion rate dropped to a rate that was lower than here in the U.S. So this is the kind of small program that we're doing to work with the Chinese. When the current administration came in the first year, we actually did receive funding from the Bush administration. Secretary Powell went to Congress, testified that UNFPA was doing good work and worthy of support. And at that time, It was right after 9/11. We got an additional amount of money from the U.S. to support our work in Afghanistan, working with refugee women. It was then Congress responded and appropriated $34 million. You're getting a long answer, but I'm getting there. We responded to $34 million, and that was then when there was concerns raised about the fact that we were doing work in China. Secretary Powell, what he did in sort of a great King Solomon way is he said, you know what, we'll just investigate this, and he sent a former U.S. ambassador, a public health doctor, and a State Department official to China to look at our program. They were there for 2 weeks. They came back. They wrote a report that's this thick, and on the cover it said it had five findings, the first being UNFPA does not support coercive practices, whether it be enforced abortion or involuntary sterilization, and two, we recommend that the funding be released. But unfortunately, they decided to ignore that report and still deny us the funding because this is their posture that by our very fact that we're working in China, it is a highly coercive context, and therefore we are indirectly supporting coercion. For the very reasons that the U.S. does not want us there, the rest of our donors do want us there because they believe that we should be working with the Chinese and holding up the flag of the U.N. and holding up the flag of human rights. So as I say, it's been very disappointing. I have hope that the U.S. will come back and join the rest of the world in supporting our work. So, and in terms of what you can do, you can tell others about this small, obscure agency that's doing important work that's worthy of support.
Thank you very much for a most informative talk. I'm mad, I'm irritated, I'm PO'd at our government for, and correct me if I'm wrong on that, for attaching strings to our foreign aid packages that they won't be used for maternal and child care, let me put it this way, family planning, that's a better term, or any such education that would lead to to birth control. Please comment.
Well, actually, the U.S. remains the largest donor bilaterally for family planning. Congress every year continues to appropriate not only funding for UNFPA, but also a robust amount of money for USAID to support family planning. Some of that funding has had these strings attached, and I'm speaking more as a private American citizen commenting on this right now than the UN. But there is something you're probably referring to is called the Mexico City Policy, which is was put in place by the president on his first day in office, which states that no U.S. non-governmental organization with its own funding can provide abortion services or advocate for changes in abortion law. And because of that provision, many providers in the field have not been able to sign it and have therefore lost their funding. This does not apply to the work of UNFPA or the UN, but it has remained a big controversial area. Last week, the House International Relations Committee had a hearing on this. I think if you go on their website, you can maybe see it webcast. And I wasn't there, but I understand it was quite lively. And this remains a huge issue of great contention in our country. And I guess for me, again, speaking personally as an American, when I travel the world, I see great need and great suffering. And women want to have healthy outcomes, and women want to have live births and children and to be able to raise them. Everyone, husbands, everyone, families. This is what people want around the world. And that this gets caught up in abortion politics is so unnecessary and so hurtful. And I don't know when we're going to come forward in the world to be able to move beyond that so that we can get people the services and the programs they need.
Good morning. I really have two questions. One is related to the United Nations Environmental Program, which released their report just this last month. And there are references to population in there. And so I'm interested in how you may collaborate with them. But my more immediate question is that people have commented that around the world, we're finding more and more women as chiefs of state and president and prime minister. we have a Secretary of State in the United States who is a woman, and we may have a candidate for presidency who will become president who is a woman. Have you noticed anything in the policy realm because, and particularly when women take over leadership roles? And I guess I would be interested in what you know about Mrs. Rice, if she said anything on these topics at all.
Oh, lots of questions there. On the UN Environment Program, we have a memo of understanding between the two agencies. Actually, throughout the work of the UN, we're all working together to be seen as more of one UN. So we see where we have integration of our programs together. I personally do a lot of work with the environmental community. I just did something last week with the Sierra Club, who have launched this wonderful initiative. They're calling it the Pink Green Initiative, pink for reproductive health, green for the environment. And you can have a house party on the Pink Green movement where they encourage you to serve pink cosmopolitans and raise funds for fistula. So go to Sierra Club if you want to learn more about that. But I can't give you great specifics on our work with UNEP, but I'd be happy to get back with you on that. Women leaders can change the world. When I was involved in the 94 Cairo conference, I had this amazing opportunity to work with some grassroots women leaders. These were women who were service providers, who weren't really advocates, who didn't see themselves as political. They actually thought politics were kind of dirty, and we worked with them to give them the voice. And of that initial group that we started working with, and they started coming to the preparatory meetings for Cairo. By the time we got to Cairo, over half of them were on their official delegations to the meetings, sitting side by side with their governments. And of that group, several of those women have now become members of parliament themselves or ministers of health. So when women are given an opportunity for leadership, they take it and they run with it. This is just a funny anecdote. One of our most successful programs is in Iran. And our former executive director, the story, I thought this was an urban myth, and I asked her, and she told me it's a true story. So she had to go to Iran, and she said, why did Iran, you know, want family planning, or what was the impetus? And they said, oh, well, when the Ayatollah was on his deathbed, he called in his daughter and said, bring family planning to Iran. Of course, his daughter was the only person in the room to hear this. So this was the leadership of his daughter. So to date, Iran has been an incredibly successful program because there's been commitment at the government level, there's been commitment by the religious community, and there's been also great involvement from the women themselves. So, and you?
I was just wondering about the American women who are most prominent.
Oh.
Rice or Mrs. Clinton, have either of them spoke specifically to the issues of reproduction in the world?
Well, I can tell you that Senator Clinton, this past fall when we had the Senate was voting on foreign operations funding, she was the chief sponsor of an amendment that would have restored funding for UNFPA, and that's the third time she's done that. So I would say Senator Clinton is a big supporter of our work. Secretary Rice, I've never heard her speak out on these issues. She, unlike her predecessor, Secretary Powell, always would sign the determination denying us funding. She has had others sign it. I could read something into that or not. I've heard her speak, and I'm very proud to hear her speak because I think she's very articulate. But I think she's stayed away from these issues directly, as far as I know.
It would be artificial to ask you to characterize the resistance you find all over the world with two words. But if you did have to do that, would the two words be religious conservatives?
I would say some of the opposition we face definitely is based in religion and culture. Some of it is. I would say some of the opposition we face is misunderstanding. I was telling Maurice earlier, our executive director is a wonderful leader. She's born in Saudi Arabia, and I firmly believe that if she had an opportunity to meet with every member of the U.S. Congress, she could win them all over, because I don't believe we have a radical agenda. I think we have an agenda to bring health and well-being to women. And I think that's something that no matter what your political or religious belief is something we should all support. So,
let me thank you for being here on behalf of a lot of us. I happen to be involved as a board member at Planned Parenthood in a four-state area that we cover. A lot of the people here I know are either involved or simpatico with Planned Parenthood. And so my question relates to how do you work, your organization work internationally with the international branch of Planned Parenthood?
Well, thank you for your work for Planned Parenthood. And International Planned Parenthood Federation is one of our key partners. We work very closely in the field. We UNFPA do not have, like, you couldn't go in anywhere and find a clinic or anything. We're not operating in that way. We provide either technical support or financial support, whether it be to a government or with an NGO partner like International Planned Parenthood Federation. So they would be a key partner to ours based on whatever country we're working in. I mean, the way our programs work is we'll work with a government at their request, we'll determine what their area of need is and develop a program and then decide who the partners are to make sure that program works. So at this meeting I was just in London, I saw IPPF there in full force, and they are a vibrant and important partner around the world.
Hi, thanks for coming. There's been a lot of studies done showing that women empowerment is directly correlated with economic empowerment. And specifically, I'm thinking of, you know, microfinance in Southeast Asia. So just out of curiosity, what is your foundation's sort of relationship with economic development organizations?
Well, economic empowerment is key for women to be able to have control over their lives. You often see if women get control of funding, they usually spend the money mostly on a greater percentage of their money on their children themselves. So getting money into the hands of women is key. We work very closely with other partner UN agencies, such as the UN Development Program, UNIFEM, UNICEF, and others, in terms of bringing support to microfinance or microcredit programs for women, increasing their access to economic literacy. When I was talking about the work in Ethiopia, a lot of what we're doing is working with these married adolescent girls to give them economic literacy. I mean, if they're not going to be able to, our ultimate goal is to get them back in school, but if they can't get back in school, to make sure that they have enough education about their health, and their economic opportunity, and have some resources. So those are critical. Another great example from Ethiopia is some women who we've been giving cows to. And you give women some cows, it's amazing how those cows start flourishing and what they're able to do in terms of dairy cooperatives. So women, as you say, women leaders, women have great power. Sometimes you just have to give them some of the tools to be able to realize it.
Ms. Craven, let me ask you a little bit about one area that you've studied is the urbanization of the poor. Tell us a little more about the challenges that that the poor are facing as they're making the move, and especially in developing worlds, from more rural areas into more urban areas.
Okay. Well, I am not an urbanization expert, but we issued our 2007 World Population Report on Urbanization. You can see it on our website. And what we found in that report is, as the world is increasingly becoming more urbanized, there is greater concentrations of poverty in urban centers. But kind of our thesis on this was that we had to focus this as not as necessarily as a detriment, as more of as an opportunity. What can that mean in terms of being able to provide health care to people in urban centers, working with religious communities and social groups, and using that as an opportunity to make smart, sound urban decisions that can reduce poverty and increase betterment for people. So you look in places like Kenya, where there's the Kibera slum, the greatest, if any of you have seen The Constant Gardener, there's that the Kibera slum there. That's the greatest concentration of the urban poor. So we want to, as the world becomes increasingly urbanized, we don't want to have that be the model. We want the model to be someplace more like in Brazil, where they've been able to have more sustainable urban architecture and agriculture and delivery of healthcare services. So the whole focus of the report is looking at the challenges of urbanization, but not and realizing that urbanization is coming and is here, but then also that you need to focus on it as an opportunity as opposed to something that we're trying to avoid. So I recommend that report to all of you, and if you email me, I can mail you one too.
I look forward to getting that report. I was recently several weeks in Latin American cities. One of the things that I'd like to ask you is, when you look at the urbanization of the world, and particularly the developing nations, into what many of us are calling megacities. Let me ask you, do you feel that most of the people who are moving to the cities, including women, are attracted to it because there is an OBGYN doctor there or something comparable? Or do you feel that the processes of, let's call it globalization, are forcing people from rural settings where maybe they have a supportive village or people who are maybe not so proficient technically, they may not be OBGYN, but they might be midwives. Do you have a view on that, and does your agency wrestle with such issues?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think it's sort of a push-pull. I mean, I think that sometimes people are seeking better opportunity in the urban areas, and so they're leaving the rural areas. Some are coming because of decreasing resources, natural resources, or economic resources, and so they're leaving the rural area. So I think it's both. I mean, for young women, it can be a great peril. I mean, women come to the urban areas thinking that they're going to seek better opportunity. They can quickly get caught into sex trafficking, or they can get caught into very unequal labor situations. So it's both. And you know, there's a need to continue to focus on the rural areas and ensure that rural health systems are able to adequately meet the needs of people in rural areas. But I would say, again, I'm not an expert in the urbanization area, but I think it's both, that people are seeking new opportunities in the urban areas or they are coming from areas that are depleted.
Ms. Craven, you mentioned the growing number of young people around the world. Do you have to change your approach to the issues that you're dealing with in developing countries with a younger audience than you're dealing with currently?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, messages are going to be different for younger people. You can use, a very effective tool in many developing countries have been these soap operas that they have on the radio, where you can get public health messages in the soap operas. They get very popular, and there was story a few years ago where one character died and people were in national mourning. And so, you know, having these soap operas where the messages might be more effective to youth, or maybe having a comic book format or something that's going to focus on them. Similarly, having special programs focused on youth. We have some areas, we have two different kinds of tracks. We have the youth who are in school, they're going to be able to access them in an in-school setting, but there are a lot of kids for various reasons, whether it's girls whose parents don't keep them in school, or kids who drop out of school. It's like really addressing those out-of-school populations is more difficult. So, for example, like in the Kibera slum area of Kenya, you know, having programs or community centers or places where these kids can come and then be able to target messages and get them health services and health delivered. So, but youth definitely tell you if you're on the money or not, and working with peer educators too. I did a program a few months ago with one of our youth advisors from Cameroon, and she was like a house on fire, and she's going to go back and work with youth in her community, and I bet that she would be much more effective than someone older than she in terms of communicating the agenda that we're talking about.
You mentioned earlier that one of the keys to changing cultural attitudes has been the grassroots efforts. How do you identify? It also seems along those lines that there are one or two people that really make a difference. How do you identify those folks when you go to some of these developing countries as folks who really can have influence from a grassroots level, but then also from a governmental level?
I think it's pretty easy when you're there to see who's effective and who's not. I mean, there's this woman named Agnes Pariyo who won the UN Person of the Year for Kenya a few years ago. She has really had great progress on addressing this issue of female genital mutilation, FGM. And she has a safe house where girls who are escaping FGM or escaping child marriage come to her house. She provides education and opportunity for them. But then she goes back and she negotiates with the community and the elders that she negotiates that these girls can come back within the community without having to undergo this cutting procedure. Now, Agnes, she's a tough lady. So it's been hard to replicate her model because no one possesses her. I mean, whatever Agnes said to me, I would agree. So, trying to find another Agnes is hard. And also, when we were in this rural Ethiopia, there was this young girl who got up. She didn't speak, she spoke the local language. And you could tell that she was the Hillary Clinton or Condoleezza Rice of her village. I mean, she was, and we videotaped her, and we came back and we were showing it to the Nike Foundation, who's one of our partners, and they're like, we have the video. They had like videotape from when they had gone of this same young woman. So you know that she was taking every opportunity that was coming her way. So finding those leaders and nourishing them and supporting them and standing back so they can lead the way.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to remind you that next Tuesday, November 13th, we will be having the second debate in our national discussion and debate series. It will be from the American Red Cross National Headquarters in Washington, D.C. at 7 p.m., and you can watch it live on WVPT. And for a full broadcast schedule, please go to our website at www.millercenter.org. Now, please join me in thanking Sarah Craven for her talk.